Brother Jenkins, I'm glad to hear someone that agrees with me that time is relative, especially for preachers. Appreciate that support. This evening, we continue our series on the great adventure as we go through 40 lessons that will carry us all the way throughout God's Word. And you know, as we look at here in the Old Testament, we look, especially as we looked last week, about the giving of the law at Mount Sinai and the events that went on there around that giving of the law, the people that were killed, the people that, you know, within 40 days of saying, "Don't speak to us anymore, let Moses speak to us lest we die," they were so afraid at hearing the voice of God speak the Ten Commandments that they didn't even want to hear it again. And yet 40 days later, they will worship a golden calf at the foot of that very same mountain, and God would send Moses down to deal with that. Well, you know, not a lot's going to change with this. You know, as I prepare these lessons talking about the Israelites, they seem to be very repetitious. These people just never seem to learn. You know, after my mama beat me a couple of times, I learned certain lessons. And yet, these people never seem to get the picture. They never seem to grasp what God is trying to teach them, and they continue to make the same mistakes over and over and over again. And this evening we're going to pretty much just talk about a few events that took place within the 40 years of wandering there of the Israelites in the wilderness. And so, you know, a lot of these things are going to be the same kind of things that we even looked at last week, just different events that are going on around those things. Well, you know, I think one thing that we learn from this as we look at these events is that we're seeing, it's not so much about what we're seeing in the Israelites, it is what we are seeing in God that we need to take note of. God is showing us His character. God is showing us what He will and will not put up with. That there are things that God does not like, that there are things that God is going to bring punishment down upon mankind if they do them. And I think those are very important lessons because God does not change ever. He has no need to change. He is perfect. So if He felt these ways in the book of Numbers or the book of Deuteronomy or the book of Exodus, if we see that He feels this way in those books in regards to the Israelites, we can be sure that He feels that way toward us today. Nothing changes with God. He is the same today as He was yesterday and till the end of time. Well, we have a list of God's wrath against sinful and rebellious people during this 40 years of wandering. Of course, the 40 years of wandering itself is a punishment for what the people did as well, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Well, we see first that they were complaining about the difficulties in the wilderness. This is in Numbers chapter 11. Pretty much all of our text will come from the book of Numbers. Numbers chapter 11, verse 1 through 3. The people were sitting there once again. We saw this last week when they were complaining about not having water, right? And they're complaining because God just brought them out to die. And they had meat and bread in their bowls. When they were in Egypt, they forgot all about being slaves, but they did have food. And yet God punished them then. And here they are again in Numbers chapter 11 in a very brief text. It says that they were complaining about God not taking care of them or doing what they wanted Him to do. And God begins to send fire down and consume people on the fringes of the camp. Literally, burning people up on the edge of the camp because of this ingratitude, of this constant griping and complaining that the people sent up before God. Also in Numbers chapter 11, it says that the people then wept in the doorways of their tents about not having meat. They were tired of manna. You know, that must be bad. That must be a hard thing. I mean, you got to remember, too, we're just a few weeks into the time in which they left. They spent some time, about 5 months, there at Mount Sinai. So, you know, we're not a long time in. They haven't been eating manna for years or anything yet at this particular point. They're going to. But at this point, and they're sitting in their tents and they're crying. They're weeping. They're mourning. Because they're sick and tired of manna. You know, it must be a hard life. You don't have to grow. You don't have to go out and sow a field, do you? You don't have to go out and kill to eat. All you got to do is get up in the morning, walk out in front of your tent, pick it up off the ground, put it in a bowl, take it in the house. That's hard. I hate that for them. You know, I mean, these people, the most ungrateful people you'll ever find in the history, probably, of the world. But we won't meet. And it was so bad. You know, you can almost gauge how bad it is at times just by Moses' response. Sometimes Moses' response is a little bit different. And Moses literally asked God why he was being so hard on him, laying the burden of these people and they're complaining on him. I'd have asked God this a long time ago. Why have you put this on me? Why do I have to put up with these people? And Moses, this is how bad it is. You know, we've all been around people, right, that gripe and complain continuously, and it does wear on you in time. But he says, God, if this isn't going to change, just kill me. Just take my life, because I just don't want to put up with these people anymore. Well, God tells the people that he is going to give them a month's worth of meat. He says, literally, till it is coming out your nostrils and that you do not like it anymore. Now, I'm about to leave on a trip, and I can tell you, I love the first part of trips because we get to stop, we get to eat burgers. I like burgers, you know. But by the end of a long trip, please don't give me another burger. They just do not taste the same. And this is what God's talking about, till it comes out of your nostrils and you can't stand it anymore. And that's exactly what he says to them here. I'm going to give you meat. You want meat, you're going to get meat. You're going to get lots and lots of it. So God literally blew in off the sea, quail. And you say, well, okay, Nathan, that's nice. But no. Let's take an accounting here of how much quail God sent in. God blew in quail, and it was 3 feet deep around the camp. I mean, you're wading through quail. You're not reaching down the ground. They're up here to nearly your waist. And, you know, you're not having to do much for these. You can just kind of scoop them up. And it was not only that. It wasn't just in the limited area. It was all the way around the camp for a day's journey. So quail, as far as you can see, here it is. All the meat you can eat. And let me tell you, they didn't let him down. Apparently, the text seems to imply that they greedily hoarded what God had provided. I mean, you can almost get this sense that they're almost running over each other to get quail. Granted, it's 3 feet deep. It's not going to run out. And so they're running over each other and just getting as much quail as they can possibly get. In fact, the Bible tells us a little bit about how much they get, literally wagon loads. Well, they didn't have Frigidaires, folks. This isn't going to keep forever. And yet they're getting wagon loads of quail. And while they were gorging themselves on the meat, it says that the meat was still in their teeth. God was completely disgusted with their greedy behavior, and he struck them with a plague that killed many of them. God does not like greedy and people that just simply are looking out for themselves and to get all that they can get. We live in a world, don't we? Get everything you can while you can and beat everybody else down getting there. That's how most of the world lives, and God's here shows us that he does not like or is not pleased with that kind of behavior. Then in Numbers chapter 13, we see the story of the 12 spies that were sent into the land of Canaan. They're now on the borderland of the land of Canaan. They've made it. It's just about a year later, and they're there. They're ready to go into the land that flows with milk and honey, and they send in 12 spies. And they spied out the land, traveling from where they were in Kadesh Barnea to Lebo Hamath, which was in the north, 200 miles. They scouted 200 miles. They came back. Joshua and Caleb, specifically Caleb, stands up. Love Caleb. He's one of those Bible characters that you just get a few little snippet verses about him, but boy, what they tell you about the guy, right? Caleb says, with God, we can do it. We can take this land. Joshua says, is right there with him as well, being another one of the spies. You know, Caleb, some 40 years later, is going to say, I'll take the area no one wants with all the warlike people. 40 years later, he's an older man at that point. He's still got that same zeal. But listen to verses 32 through 33 of Numbers 13. It says, so they gave out to the sons, these are the other 10 spies, so they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. And there also we saw Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight. That's not a very good report, is it? You know, here's the land that flows with milk and honey. This is the land we've been traveling to get to. Been going through the wilderness. God's promised us all this great stuff, and that ain't too good. And so, you know, but before I move on into that rest of that story, I want us to stop right there and note what they say. Look what they said. They said, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. Folks, we need to be careful that we do not have grasshopper faith. Because that's really what they had here. You know, it doesn't matter what other people think about us. It doesn't matter if the sons of Anak or the Nephilim or whoever it was, the Amalekites or the Perizzites or any of those ites, right, that they list there in regards to the people that lived in Canaan. It doesn't matter if they viewed the Israelites as grasshoppers. That's not our concern. I don't care what other religious groups think about us, whether they want to call us a cult or whatever they want to call us. It really doesn't matter to me. They're going to say what they want to say, and I can't change that or stop that, and probably, and so I'm not going to worry with that. But what I do worry about is when we begin to believe the hype, right? When we begin to believe the propaganda that people are putting out there. See, Jericho probably looked down and laughed on them marching around the walls, right? But it didn't matter what the people of Jericho thought. It only mattered that the children of Israel were doing what God had commanded them to do. But when we begin to feel like grasshoppers in our own eyes, we are in trouble, just like the spies were in trouble. Because our faith has shrunk. We've stopped being children of God and we started being something much less. We've stopped serving a God that can do anything. And we're serving a God that obviously has limitations in our own minds. We need to be careful. Because when we do that, we will have a lack of faith. It will cause us to flee when we should advance. It will cause us to reject God when we should pull closer to Him in faith, just as these spies did. I love that we were grasshoppers in our own eyes. We looked at ourselves and said, man, we're small, instead of looking at what God could do. Well, the people became so upset. Oh, they just couldn't believe this report. Everybody was just completely overwhelmed with how terrible this report was. In fact, you don't find it in the book of Numbers, but you do find it in the book of Nehemiah, chapter 9 and verse 17, where it says that not only were they upset, but they chose another leader. They went and they chose someone else to lead them back to Egypt. So we have insurrection here. We have rebellion against God's leadership that He had put into place, the leadership of Moses and Aaron. You know, none of these nations would have compared to Egypt militarily. They would not have compared to Egypt in wealth. They would not have compared to Egypt in people. Egypt was, at the time that the Israelites were slaves, they're the most powerful nation in the world. And yet you saw what God did to them. Why can't these people remember that? You got little, basically, and I know this is a Greek a term for Greek cities, but you got basically little city-states is all you got. Not nations, really. And they don't think God can handle that after He literally laid into the dust an entire empire. Without them even having to lift a finger, He destroyed them. And yet, God has promised, I will drive them out before you, yet they will not hear. You know, this leader that they appointed may very well have been a man named Korah. And he is a man that we're going to see almost in events immediately after this rebelling against the leadership again of Moses and Aaron. Well, the people prepared to stone Moses. This is serious. This isn't just people mourning in their tents and weepy crying at their tent doors or out in the street. This is serious. They are getting together to stone Moses. They are ready to put him to death and follow Korah or whoever the leader was back to Egypt. And just as they were coming to Moses to stone him, the glory of God descended upon the tabernacle. I'd love to have seen that. Because whatever it was, and it appears to be a type of cloud, but there appears to be more to it than that. But when God descended down upon the tabernacle, let me tell you what, it got people's attention. And it brought the stoning of Moses to an abrupt halt. God's on the scene now. In a representative form, grant you, but He's on the scene. And they are stopped in their tracks, and God is ready to kill them all. He is. I think He's about had it about like Moses has. In fact, God's already, He told Moses that at the time of the golden calf. I'll just kill them all. I'll keep my promise to Abraham through you. But once again, Moses, and this is a guy, remember, who's just sick and tired of all the complaining. He's asked to even be killed if it's not going to change. But he intercedes for the people. He begs God not to kill them. He is begging God not to kill the people that were probably picking up or carrying rocks to stone him, right? Do we understand better as we look at Moses and his dealings with these people? Do we understand better how he is, how the prophecy in regards to Christ, that one like unto you will come? That Jesus Christ, that Moses is a foreshadowing of Jesus Christ? That he is literally mediating or making intercession to God for the people that would kill him. Jesus died on the cross for the man that drove the nails in his hands. He died on the cross for Pilate, for Judas, for Caiaphas. And yet here is Moses interceding to save the people that hated him and wanted to kill him. We begin to see God's plan so clearly. God decrees that they will die in the wilderness. They will not enter the land. God says, fine, I won't kill them right now, but I'm going to kill them. Because they asked for it. I didn't tell you that, but earlier before that, when they heard this terrible report, they said, oh, if God would just let us die, just kill us in the wilderness. God says, okay, be careful what you ask. God is willing to give. God says, I won't kill them right now, but they're going to die. They're not entering my promised land. And so he said, I'll march them around for 40 years until they're all dead. Everyone above the age of 20, save two men, Joshua and Caleb, the ones that said we can. And they will. Well, Moses tells the people this, tells them what God has said. Obviously, God descending upon the tabernacle has gotten their attention. They have once again kind of at least to return their focus to God and at least to what they know what He can do. Maybe it's jogged their memory just a little bit. And it says, the Bible tells us that they mourned when they heard what God had said. And the next day they decided to do what they should have done at the very beginning. They come up and they go, oh, we're ready now. We'll take up our arms. We'll go into that land and we'll take it. Moses said, no, you won't. Folks, there are things we do in this life that it's too late once we've done them. Now, there's going to come a day when we draw the last breath of life, and folks, at that point, it'll be too late to make a change. The people here want to make a change, but God has already said, and He's made it clear, and Moses tells them, it's too late. You will not go into the land. But they say, oh yeah, we will. We're going to go in there. They should have listened to Joshua and Caleb, but they didn't. They listened to 10 cowards. Here they are. They said they were going to invade it. Moses says, no, they don't listen to Moses again. I mean, see, these people don't learn. And they arm up and they head into the land of Canaan, and they get what we called in the Deep South, whooped. They get chased back, as the Bible puts it, by a swarm of bees. And that's how it was describing the armies of the Amalekites, that they chased them back. All they had to do was trust God, didn't they? But a failure to trust God is going to cost them their lives in the wilderness. Failure to look to God, as Caleb did and as Joshua did, is going to leave them, is going to not permit them to get into the promised land. Well, then we see the most serious rebellion and threat to Moses' leadership, and that was led by a man named Korah, Numbers chapter 16. That's why we say it might have been Korah that was appointed. Maybe he already had, you know, a little taste of power here and kind of wanted to find a way to get it back. Korah was a cousin of Moses. This is kinfolk. You've got to watch those kinfolk. You know, he's in the family. He's a Levite. And he wants to lead, and he's gotten with and he's plotted with some men of the tribe of Reuben, and he has acquired 250 followers. And after he had done that, nearly all of Israel, all of the Israelites then join with him and side with him against Moses. He appears to have been quite the politician. Moses isn't about politicking, is he? God certainly isn't about politics. Well, Korah wanted to supplant Aaron and Moses, and Moses established a test. Is Aaron really the only man that can be the high priest? Is he the only one that can occupy that office? Well, let's have a test. You take your staves and you carve a name on them and you set them over here and we'll see who God chooses, right? The staff of Aaron not only does, of course, you've got to remember this dead piece of wood sprouts. It literally buds. Not only does it just bud, it even puts out almonds, making it clear that God chose Aaron. That wasn't enough. That wasn't good enough for them. This is that same rod, though, that would be placed in the Ark of the Covenant, near the Ark of the Covenant at a time, in the Ark of the Covenant as well, later to show that only the lineage of Aaron could occupy this office. Korah and his followers were then, as a result, God made it clear who it was. That's clear for the people. I don't think God in this particular situation was making it clear to Korah. Korah had already sealed his fate by rebelling. It didn't matter what Korah finds out at this particular moment. I think his fate was already sealed because the earth opens up, swallows him, his tent, and his stuff, closes back up. Korah's gone. He couldn't politic himself out of that one, could he? And the 250 followers that he had, and they were carrying incense, and they wanted to go into the tabernacle and do what was not their job to do, God sent fire and consumed them. They would literally take the metal from the censers and would make a plate to hang on the altar as a remembrance. Don't try to do what God has not asked you to do. Oh, there's so many lessons from that. I mean, you know, that's a Nadab and Abihu moment, isn't it? In more ways than one, more than just the fire, but also being presumptive in what you're going to do in worship. Being presumptive in how you approach God. Instead of doing it the way God asked to do it, we can see here that God plainly is not pleased when we assume that we know better than Him how He wants us to worship. And here, these 250 men paid the price along with Korah. Well, even after these events took place, you know, the people, they don't turn back at this particular point. No. They go, Moses, all you're doing is killing your brethren. They're blaming Moses. And they continue to disrespect him, so God sent a plague. And the people are dying right and left. And Aaron, Moses is interceding. Aaron then takes his censer, the incense censer, and he runs out in the middle of these people that are dying in mass. And he stands out there, and the ones on one side live, and the other ones on the other side die. He's interceding in between them. And you might say, well, Nathan, what's the big deal about that? Well, other than the symbolism, Aaron, as the high priest, could never come in contact with something dead. So it was a great risk to go out there. But he stood and he stopped the plague. The plague was stopped as a result of Aaron's actions and Moses' actions. But before it stopped, 14,700 people fell dead that day. Folks, God is serious. So many people today approach religion in some kind of play around way, and God is a serious God, and He doesn't put up or suffer fools long. And we need to be aware of that. We reverently approach Him, or we suffer the consequences. Well, in the 40th year of the wandering, and I'm jumping, you know, we can't cover everything these people did over 40 years, but in the 40th year, a lot of events happened. It begins with Miriam dying. Miriam was beloved by the camp. She is Moses' sister. She was, for a time, smitten with leprosy because her and Aaron thought that they were somehow on the same level with Moses, and God made it clear, no, you're not. You know, I may have something to do with you, but nothing like I have to do with Moses. She was struck with leprosy for that vanity, but she was also healed later. Moses in this same year would strike the rock instead of speaking to it, right? You know, there's a part of you, isn't there, that kind of feels like that's not fair? Just down in your gut. But it shows you how God feels about even one sin. One transgression. One sin destroys all the good you've ever done in God's eyes, as long as that sin's there. It doesn't matter. God's not going to weigh it against your good. All He sees is a sin. Moses, just as elders today, preachers, deacons, he was held to a higher account. He set the example. And he failed. And he paid a heavy price. He would not enter the land of Canaan. Then we see that the Edomites opposed the Israelites, made them go further out into the desert, into an area that would have probably been in the range of temperatures in 110, 120 degrees. And once again, they start complaining. And once again, God is not going to have it. And He sends fiery serpents in, right? They begin to bite them. They begin to die. I don't like snakes. Cheryl says she had a big serpent on her driveway last night. They begin to bite them. Moses raises up a brass serpent. Another foreshadowing of our Lord. And all they had to do was look at that brass serpent and they would be healed. That's all you had to do. And you know, there's just a part of me, just the cynical preacher side of me, that just believes there's some Israelite out there who's bit and he's dying. He goes, I ain't going to look at it. I just feel it, because that's how these people were. And there very well may have been, I don't know. But I know people, and I've seen people about that stubborn, haven't you? Well, several ways in which that brass serpent is like Christ, that without it, you were dead. That it was lifted up, just as Christ was lifted up. He said, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to me. That it was available to all. Anybody could look. It wasn't just available to one group or one tribe. It was available to anyone. It was the only salvation. There was no other way to be cured of these snake bites. That was the only way. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except by me. John chapter 14 and verse 6. It was sure salvation. It wasn't, maybe you'll be healed. God didn't say, maybe you look at the serpent and we'll kind of roll the dice and we'll see if you get healed. It'll be kind of a chance. No, it wasn't a chance. You look, you're saved. That's all you had to do. It required faith. That faith that says, if I look, God will save me. And it's the same thing with us in Christ. Well, we also see in this 40th year, Aaron dies on Mount Hor. Then we see also the Moabite immorality. And you know, this is interesting. This is what is referred to in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 8, that on this particular day, 24,000. Now, there's two different numbers, 23 and 24, but it's simply making, there were 1,000 executed. So if you added the ones that were killed by God in the plague, the ones that were executed is 24 or 23. Both numbers are correct. Some people like to find those things and say, oh, see, I found a contradiction in the Bible. That's not. You know, the problem, if they just read their Bibles a little bit more than just one verse, they'd find out a whole lot of things they need to know. But you know, it was so brazen. The Moabites, on the advice of Balaam, the man who the donkey spoke to, who he's going to end up losing his life over this situation as well, Balaam told him, he said, if you want them to get separated from their God, send your women in for immorality with their men. And their God will not put up with this. Even he understood, God ain't going to put up with this stuff. Folks, we look at the immorality around us. We need to be at least smart, as smart or smarter than Balaam, right? God ain't going to put up with it. So they sent their women in. In fact, it became so brazen that a Simeonite man brought his Moabite woman and paraded her right through the camp and to his tent. And thank goodness there was one man that had a zeal for God, and his name was Phinehas, the son of Aaron. And Phinehas wasn't going to have it. It was not going to happen in his eye, in his sight. He picks up a spear, he goes in the tent, and drives it through both of them, killing them. And God said, that's the kind of guy I want. Somebody who will stand up for me and for what I say is right. 24,000 die. And then we also see in that last year the death of Moses as he gets to go and gets to see the promised land from the top of the mountain, Mount Nebo. But then he dies and he is succeeded by Joshua. Well, that's the end of our wandering. They're going to go into the land of Canaan in our next lesson in our Great Adventure series. But I want us to remember so that we do not make the mistakes that the Israelites made. We need to remember what God has done. Folks, you need to take time to look back over your life and see what God has done. As the song says, to count your many blessings, right? To see how He has blessed you all throughout your life, how He has brought you to where you are, and how He has gotten you through the difficult times. And so when you face difficult times now, unlike the Israelites, you don't forget. But you say, He helped me through before. He will help me through again. Because He's that kind of God. May we also remember not only what God has done, but what He can do. And that also, may we have a greater faith than that of a grasshopper, right? May we see ourselves for what we are. That we are the children of God. Who can come between us and God? No one. No one can separate me from the love of Christ. No one can take the salvation that God has given to me through His Son from me. No one can do anything about my relationship with Jesus Christ. No one. When we have that kind of faith, we will not shy away. We will not run away. And we certainly won't sit around and complain like the Israelites did. Because we'll realize what a great value we are and what a great responsibility and blessing we've been given. This evening, if you're not a child of God, we hope and pray that you'll become one by obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ, by believing in Him, repenting of your sins, confessing Jesus Christ as the Son of God, being buried in baptism, dying there, rising to walk a new life, having your sins washed away there. A life where you remember what God did right at that moment, how He changed your life, how He made a difference. He did what no one else could do. And go forth always trusting what He can do, what He will do, all the way to heaven. If you're a child of God tonight, maybe you have been a grasshopper in your sight. Maybe you've looked at the world and what all is going around you and go, I can't stand up against that. I'm a grasshopper in their sight and I've become a grasshopper in my own sight. Remember who you are. You're God's child and nothing's impossible with God. Remember Mary? What did Mary say? She said, how can this be? I'm a virgin. He said, nothing's impossible with God. And folks, now that's a pretty hard one to get a hold of, isn't it? She turns right around and says, behold your bond slave. You do what you need to do. I believe. May you have that kind of attitude. If you haven't, change today. We can assist you in any way. Won't you come as we stand, as we sing.